warrant is released and Liz Cheney goes down, presumably. We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry. I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Alexander Zandasanctis, and the Sage of Authenticity Woods, Jim Garrity. You are, of course, listening to a National View podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Ball & Brand Sheets and Moink. More about them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So, Jim, we'll talk about this a little bit more, your fantastic French vacation, but you were away when this epic and missed this epic news cycle, which is still upon us, surrounding the FBI raid of Mar-a-Lago. We learned more the end of last week. The warrant was released, including a rundown of the items the FBI took from Mar-a-Lago, which included top secret information. Doesn't necessarily mean, you know, it's what you think it is, you know, a list of classified agents, but there certainly was secret material down there. And Trump people claim that he issued a blanket declassification of basically everything he took. But at least the conventional wisdom is this is provides some what appears to be serious justification for this raid, and Republicans have been a little less fulsome in their denunciations of the search since the release of the warrant. What do you make of it?
Rich, as you've noticed, every time I travel out of town and I leave the Morning Jolt to the likes of the illustrious Alexander DeSantis or Isaac Shore, I always have this sense that something huge is going to blow up, and I love leaving it for Alexandra and Isaac to deal with. And as I saw the news blowing up, it was a big deal over there in France as well. I was like, oh, man, oh, man, am I glad I'm not back there. Don't have to deal with this. But I knew it was going to stick around when we got here. I find my feelings on this and my thoughts on this surprisingly complicated. Do I find it plausible, believable, heck, even probable that Donald Trump took documents that had classified information or that had sensitive defense information that should have been kept at a government facility to his home in Mar-a-Lago? Yes, absolutely plausible, likely even. Do I think, and it sounds like there had been extensive negotiations between National Archives and government officials and the Trump people. Trump said he turned over everything. The National Archives believed he didn't. Apparently, there was some sort of inside source who was saying, no, there's a bunch of stuff he hasn't returned, and here's where you can find it. Now, look, I think it's, as you wrote and a whole bunch of my colleagues observed over the past week, this is a really unprecedented step. And this is the sort of thing where, under the law, if Donald Trump broke the law, then yes, this is a crime, should be prosecuted, should be handled. You know, this if the law says it's got to be kept in a government facility, it's got to be kept in a government facility. There is no Trump gets the exception, and no, he cannot just declassify it verbally. There's an established procedure for this. Courts have ruled this. You can't just decide it's declassified. You got to fill out the forms, etc.
I don't know. Is that true, Jim? I'm not sure whether that's ever been. Has that been litigated and established? My understanding is it's kind of a murky area.
Indeed it has. And it was mentioned in today's Morning Jolt, Rich, at least in one case.
Podcast, Trump, but that should have been part of my preparation.
That's right. So Trump had made several references to aid we had given to Syrian rebel groups back during the Obama years. And So the New York Times filed a FOIA request saying, well, if the president's talked about it, it's no longer classified. You can't say it's classified, so we can't respond to your FOIA request. And the government's argument was, yes, it was. And this went back and forth. And the Second Court of Appeals basically said, there's an established procedure, even for presidents. You can't just, you know, say, poof, it's done so. You get the president talking about a topic does not automatically declassify the topic. So that's the court precedent in this so far. Now, could a different court look at this and rule differently? I suppose. I saw the article in Politico this morning that said, if Trump can prove that he had this blanket one, if it's written down somewhere, okay, then it's a different story. But you can't just say, I declare declassification, and that makes it declassified.
Yeah, it sounds like what they're going to be relying on is the magic wand, is the pointing at that box and saying, it's declassified, bring it. Or maybe just bring it. And the most maximalist version of their case may be that if he wanted it at Mar-a-Lago, it was declassified. And I think there's been suggestions of that argument.
Yeah, but you know, at least as of this court decision, the establishment is there's an established procedure for this laid out in one of the executive orders that has to be followed. And if it's not followed, then it's not declassified. But anyway, moving on from all this, that if we know the way Trump responds to, he believes that the deep state is out to get him. Quite a few listeners probably suspect that there's some evidence that the deep state is out to get him. Certainly, there are people within the federal government who hate his guts and would love to see him indicted and behind bars. So Trump, we know this is basically going to DEFCON 1 for Trump, that if you execute this search warrant, this is going to have an apoplectic reaction and that Trump is not going to do anything but pour gasoline on the fire. So my attitude for this is that, look, based on what they're describing, it sounds justified. But boy, oh boy, prosecutors and investigators and FBI, I hope you know what you're doing and I hope this is worth it. Because a lot of Americans are going to see this as, wait a minute, he's the president. It's Mar-a-Lago. It's not like he's leaving these out on a hotel lobby somewhere. This is a secure facility. It's always got the Secret Service there. This seems like a really ticky-tack thing to go after him on, particularly when a couple of years back, James Comey looked at this, all the classified information on Hillary Clinton's email servers, and said, look, no reasonable prosecutor would go after this, would consider this to be a crime. Now, I know you can make the argument that Trump had intent to bring this, or that Trump had been asked and said that he turned it all over, and thus he's effectively lying to the government or things like that. This seemed like a really big step for the Department of Justice to take, a very consequential step. And I hope Merrick Garland and everybody else in the government knew what they were doing and is ready for the consequences. Because, as we already saw, within an instant, this had already changed the dynamics of the GOP, but brought Trump front and center.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Christopher Wray. Thank you, General Garland. So, Zan, I totally believe it. Could Trump have been sloppy with his stuff? Yes. I mean, there's extensive reporting about how sloppy he was and other incidents not having directly to do with this one. And is it possible to believe that he got, his backup and he's just like, this stuff is mine, and just sort of wanted it just because the fact they were asking for it made him want it more? And that they were dishonest, obviously completely easy to believe. Where I get off the train is if the facts are different, I'll admit it. I'll say I was wrong. My assumption was wrong, but I just kind of find it hard to believe that this is like top secret stuff of the sort your mind immediately goes with top secret stuff. I was talking to a former intelligence professional. He was saying stuff that gets this top secret classification. Yeah, it might be lists of classified agents. It also might be a transcript of a call with Emmanuel Macron. And it's easy to see Trump, who loves mementos and loves having things to talk about and brag about, wanting a transcript of a call with Macron. See where I stuck it to this fraud of an SOB. And that's, he's not supposed to have that. It's not his property, but it's also not like having a blueprint of a hypersonic missile in his sock drawer. And then there's the immediately we've had seen this, the same sort of dynamic as we did with the Russia investigation, where instantly everyone goes to the very worst possibilities and begins to talk about them as though, that they're happening, like we know it. There was someone on a Sunday show who was saying these secrets could have been worth billions of dollars, if you're selling them to the Russians. And that just seems like an extravagant spy novel type scenario to me.
Yeah, I don't believe anything like that. I think it's very likely what you're saying. I assume some of it, I think there's good reason to believe some of it was taken unintentionally, or we know that Trump, and we've watched him operate as president, as someone who doesn't really care very much about the rules or traditions or the various prescriptions for how one's supposed to operate in the office of the president. He doesn't respect those types of things, and that doesn't mean he's hoarding things that he wants to sell to foreign governments or release in any kind of dangerous way. I think he probably some of it was taken mistakenly, and even once he knew, then he just doubled down, and he spent the last 2 years or almost 2 years now basically in a blind fit of rage over thinking the election was stolen from him. And he went into office on this narrative of having been persecuted by the government, by his political opponents. A lot of that was true. And so I think he always has this kind of victim mentality. He's always the one being persecuted. He's always being attacked unfairly. He's always being scrutinized. And there is some truth to a lot of that. And so I think this is just another example of, well, he's going to double down and insist on keeping what he has and not give it back. He doesn't really care about whether it's right, whether it's legal for him to have it. To him, he was president. He gets to keep what he wants. He still thinks he should have been president again. He thinks he actually won, I think, though he doesn't have good reason to believe that. And so he's basically just fighting back and seeing this as another instance of being persecuted by his political opponents.
So Charlie, Andy did spike the ball in the end zone after he saw this warrant, because there's an appendix. I think there's subsection C that says, oh, and by the way, you can take any record produced by Donald Trump during the 4 years of his presidency. And Andy's belief has been from the beginning that this was a pretextual raid. They're not going to prosecute him on any of these offenses related to the mishandling of classified documents. What they wanted is to try to find something that would advance the case on January 6th, maybe something that went to Trump's motives, which is a key element they got to get if they want to have any chance of making a prosecution stick. And oh, by the way, this is happening at the same time you had all these other January 6th related searches and seizures of phones. So where are you on the pretextual question, or just too hard to know?
Well, I'm not sure that the broad nature of the warrant answers that question for us, in that if the Department of Justice were indeed setting up a pretextual search, then it would need to have a warrant that covered any information that had been generated at any point during Trump's presidency. But also, wouldn't it do that if it weren't pretextual? If the problem here is that Donald Trump, as others have in other circumstances, is in possession of documents that he shouldn't be, if the problem is that Donald Trump's conduct is out of line with the Presidential Records Act, wouldn't you need a warrant that permitted the searching agents to look at and possibly confiscate anything that fell under the Presidential Records Act? And the Presidential Records Act applies to Trump's tenure. So if you were looking for documents that might in some way be sensitive, that might be related specifically to nuclear weapons or nuclear diplomacy, you couldn't reasonably say, and this warrant only applies from the 9th of June 2017 to the 7th of August. You would have to make it broad. So, you know, I'm not sure that that in and of itself tells us a great deal. Where I think Andy is probably onto something is that, unless I am mistaken, being out of line with the Presidential Records Act is not usually a justification for a search warrant executed on a former president. That's the part of this equation that I find a little alarming, that this was unjustified, that it was...
Well, so that's why they would need all the other stuff. You're obstructing justice, you're violating the Espionage Act, so that's why we're going in.
Right, right. But if you're going to enforce that law, then you're going to have a broad search warrant, because Trump is not allowed any of the information that he has kept, irrespective of on what date it was generated.
So, Jim, we would be remiss if we didn't mention this terrible incident out in Cincinnati. Guy shows up, presumably enraged by this search, and tries to breach the FBI office there, and then ends up being shot. Was he brought down by the authorities? I don't know whether he was killed by law enforcement. And, you know, we made a lot, justifiably, of the attempted assassination of Brett Kavanaugh. And here you have a guy, obviously spun up, you know, but to some extent, we need to know more details by the all the electricity around this. How do you consider that that case?
I'm reminded of Cesar Sayoc, the guy who was mailing pipe bombs to Trump critics. and who that story managed to, you know, dominate the headlines. I want to believe it was in the final weeks or the last month or so before the 2018 midterms, doing Republicans no favors. Look, there are a lot of nut jobs in this world. The last thing I wrote about before heading out was the verdict on Alex Jones. And this sense of, do we have more crazy people? Does it feel like you end up dealing with more crazy people than you used to? And Rich, I don't mean in the context of National Review meetings. I just in the sense of, you know, are there more people where you hear them and their worldview is that the world is the moon is made of green cheese? I mean, there's just something that's just totally out there. And they are, you know, there are. I'm very much a believer in the First Amendment. I'm very much a believer that you should not self-police your speech for fear that it could set off some nut job, because you don't really know it's going to set off some nut job because they're nut jobs. Their minds don't work in a logical way or something like that. But I think it's safe to say that intense demonization of a political figure, a political side, gives some of these nutty people a worldview in which their desire to do antisocial things allows them to do something bad, and can be convinced that it is something morally justified. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was apparently the kind of guy who would, like, you know, torture chickens and kill animals and you know, was an absolute psycho. But radical Islam gave him a worldview in which, hey, you know all these terrible impulses you have? Well, here's a way that they can be morally justified. And I do think that certain ideologies give people this sense like, oh, okay, I can do this because it's okay now. This person over here is really bad. Because of this news event, this nut job out in Cincinnati said the FBI is evil. The FBI is not incompetent or flawed or made up of human beings that make mistakes. No, it is a malevolent force and I must attack it because it has become this fascist, terrible force or something like that. Obviously, it'd be terrific if we could get everybody to tone down the rhetoric. Clearly, Trump's never going to do that. And this is just, you know, a fact of life in America of 2022. We have a whole bunch of people who are looking for an excuse to do something violent. And we have all too many politicians who are perfectly happy to play with fear and anger and resentment and rage. And they're juggling nitroglycerin and they don't even care.
Yeah, Suzanne, this is just, we've talked about this before. This is just another instance where you have unreliable narrators, to say the least, on both sides. You can't necessarily, after Russia, you can't believe the authorities, and you gotta kick the tires to make sure they haven't overreacted or maybe are beholden to a political agenda. But Trump is just so demagogic, right? I mean, it's just ridiculous. They might have been planting stuff, you know, they're occupying Mar-a-Lago, just every sentence designed to play on people's worst sort of fears, which is, of course, I mean, it goes without saying, this is putting it mildly, is the very opposite of statesmanship, which was supposed to be involved in refining public sentiment, not hyping up and giving permission to its crudest and most dire elements.
Yeah, I find these types of news cycles very hard to follow and hard to make sense of because there are so few voices who are trustworthy. And in lieu of, or while we're waiting for more clear information to come out, basically, everybody who's talking about it has no idea what they're saying, but is speaking as though they know everything or as though they know facts, not yet in evidence, or they're trying to use it and/or they're trying to use it to confirm the worst fears of people who already agree with them, or, you know, kind of gin up support for their side among people who already agree with them. And this is happening both among Democrats and with, you know, the usual very staunch Trump can do no wrong supporters. And there's very few voices in the middle saying, here's what we actually know. Here are some possible interpretations of what we know. Here's what we don't know yet, and the ways that what we don't know might change the conclusions that we draw. And that, I think, is in a nutshell why these types of situations for the past 5 or 6 years or whatever it's been, and this has been happening in politics for longer than that, but with Trump in particular, have been so toxic and divisive for our politics and our kind of public discourse, because it's really just everybody doubles down in the position they already had before whatever it has happened, and no one cares about the facts at all. All they care about is somehow confirming what they already believed or who they already supported.
So, Charlie, last thing before we move on from this segment, we have news word that Rudy Giuliani is a target in the January 6th related probe down in Georgia. this is just another indication of how serious the authorities are. I think both in Georgia and at the Justice Department in pursuing some sort of charges related to January 6th. And, you know, this isn't Merrick Garland, obviously, but I think it will increase the pressure. He's already been under incredible pressure to hasten his decision-making in terms of charging people, because he doesn't want to be preempted by, you know, these folks, these prosecutors down in Georgia and this big epic historic case. But what's your read on the state of play at the moment?
One of the words we read a lot these days is unprecedented. And that word can be appropriate and it can be an excuse. And it can be an excuse when you're looking at someone being treated differently than someone who had done the same thing would in a similar situation. And that's why I have struck a skeptical note on Trump and on this search and on the enthusiasm with which the Department of Justice seems to be pursuing or ostensibly pursuing records violations. But then there's a side of this that is unprecedented, because what happened in 2020 was unprecedented. The machinations of John Eastman and others notwithstanding, no one had thought since the late 19th century that the vice president was an elections dictator. No one had thought that it would be appropriate to put pressure on state secretaries of state to find votes. Nobody had thought that it would be optional for the incumbent president to leave office, or virtuous for him to, let's say, acquiesce to, if not encourage or incite mobs to enter the legislative chamber. And as a result, we are going to see unprecedented investigations and potentially unprecedented indictments. Now, it's worth saying with Rudy seems to be under investigation. He hasn't been indicted. He may not be indicted. But I think in this case, unlike with the search of Mar-a-Lago, the targets of these investigations brought it on themselves by behaving in a way that has no parallel. What do you do if you are the Department of Justice or the FBI or state level equivalents in this circumstance? Nobody knows. And so we're going to read stories in the New York Times about this person or that person being investigated because there's no playbook for this.
So, Jim Garrity, exit question to you. At this juncture, you believe it is more likely than not that Donald Trump will be charged with a crime related to January 6th somewhere by someone, whether it's down in Georgia, whether it's the U.S. Department of Justice. More likely than not, yes or no?
Yes, and I just want to add one note on Rudy Giuliani. I do think, as much like, oh, this is, you know, we're going to get Rudy Giuliani and we're going to get him indicted, he's going to jail. No, not so fast. I think Rudy Giuliani has put a lot of work into laying an extensive groundwork for an insanity defense.
Zan, more likely than not, yes or no? 51%.
Yeah, that, I guess I'll say yes as well, by someone somewhere, but I don't think it'll be anything that will stick at all.
Charlie?
I think he won't be indicted, or at least I think it is less than more likely that
right.
he will
so
be
you're,
indicted.
You're sticking. That's last time we asked, that's where you were. I was with you last time. I'm abandoning you, Charlie. I'm going with Jim and Zan. More likely than not, I don't think it doesn't make it a lead pipe cinch. You know, down in Georgia, I do think, by the way, that the fake electors are getting totally screwed. If they're going to get charged, you know, they thought they were putting themselves forward in case Trump's case down there succeeded, in which case, if it actually succeeded and then there were no Trump electors and the deadlines had passed, then the whole thing would have been moot. So they thought they were offering themselves in a provisional manner, and that they would be charged with some sort of crime on that basis is completely ridiculous. I also think just the phone call itself, on any sort of moral commonsensical standard, it was atrocious. On a legal standard, I don't know how you get him on that call. I mean, he's talking quite sincerely, if insanely, about a pool of 400,000 fraudulent votes. He has two or three lawyers on the call with them. The takeaway at the end of the call is from the lawyers is, hey, we are absolutely convinced. I think the number is 24,000. We have 24,000 votes that we think are fraudulent or invalid. We've checked it two or three times. We have different experts look at it. Can you please tell us how we're wrong? Can we please have a meeting at least where you can share more information so we can better evaluate these votes? No one's going to jail for that. For that call, if it really comes to that, because it's just a defense lawyer, there's just a lot of material to work with. But I have a sense of foreboding about this. I think Garland the pressure's worked on him, and he's going to do it, and it's going to be terrible. It's just going to be terrible for the country. I think Zan is right. Probably ultimately won't stick, you know. But can you convict him in a DC jury? Yeah, of course you can. I doubt it would stick over the long term, but what a painful episode this will be if we actually go down this path. And it will put the country closer to some sort of breaking point. I'm not a Civil War guy, and that's not what I'm suggesting, but it will be, we'll be passing through another gate towards a new kind of divisiveness. So hope it doesn't happen. Hope I'm wrong, but I do think it's more likely than not. With that, let's hear from our first sponsor this episode, Ball and Branch Sheets. And Charlie, it's going to be an all Charlie Cook episode in terms of our sponsor reads, because you are huge fans of both of our products today. But let's go to Ball and Branch first.
Hang on. I pressed the wrong button on my phone, but now I press the right button on my phone and I have the read for Ball and Branch, which is, as you say, one of my favorite products, one of my favorite sponsors of this podcast, because I myself sleep on Boll & Branch sheets. Did you know that thread count is a myth? Because it doesn't matter how many threads your sheets have if they're not the best threads possible. And Boll & Branch's threads are the best threads possible because they use the best 100% organic cotton threads on earth for a superior softness and a better night's sleep. Their sheets aren't just buttery, breathable, and impossibly soft to start. They get softer with every wash. Now, you're hearing me explain this to you. I've said before, my wife likes these sheets too, but I think the acid test is that we just can't get our two small kids out of our bed. They come in the middle of the night. They want to come in the evening. Sometimes they just sit on the bed in the middle of the day. And I think this is because of the thread count on the Boll & Branch sheets. Even at the ages of 4 and 6, they have exquisite taste and they know that Boll & Branch is better. And that's why they spend as much time as they can, much to my chagrin, on the signature hemmed sheets from Boll & Branch, which are a bestseller for a reason. The sheets are made with threads so luxurious, they are beloved by 3 US presidents. They feel buttery to the touch, they're super breathable, so they're perfect for every season, and they have over 10,000 stellar reviews. I guess we can make that 10,000 and... 2. They come in 9 neutral colors, all in all sizes, from twin up to California King, and you will immediately feel the difference because they're 100% free from toxins, meaning no pesticides, formaldehyde, or other harsh chemicals you get on inferior sheets. They fit the deepest of mattresses. They're labeled with top and bottom tags, so making your bed is easier than ever, I'm told. And best of all, Boll & Branch gives you a 30-night risk-free trial with free shipping and returns on all orders. So if you don't like them, which you will, you could theoretically send them back. But instead, you should order some. And if you do, you'll get 15% off your first set of sheets when you use the promo code EDITORS15 at their website, ballandbranch.com. That's ballandbranch, B-O-L-L-A-N-D, branch.com. And the promo code is EDITORS15.
Wow, Charlie, that was your best read ever. I just aspire one day to my quip reads to be that quick. That was fantastic. Anyone out there, you're just not listening. Your heart is hardened like stone if you didn't listen to that read and believe you have to go out and check out Ball and Branch sheets, which you do. So Zan, kind of related to what we were just talking about, we're recording here late Tuesday morning, our accustomed time, and the first ep of the week. And as we speak, you have Republican voters in Wyoming voting in the primary out there, Liz Cheney at large seat. And seems likely, I wouldn't be shocked if Cheney gets 25%. There's some people think she'll go higher because there are indications of major major crossover voting from Democrats who have re-registered as Republicans and have decided that all of a sudden they're Cheney fans for the first time in 40 years out there in Wyoming, and that maybe booster up to 30 or more. But it's obvious that she's going to lose. What do you make of it?
Well, yeah, I think I agree. I mean, you don't really know fully till the votes are counted, but it seems fair to assume that she's going down. I'm not really sure what to make of this yet, in the sense that on the one hand, I think she's taken a lot of positions, made a lot of decisions, particularly with regard to the January 6th committee and how she's handled that whole issue, which is why she's going to lose if she does, that I deeply disagree with. I think that she's wrong. And while I, of course, think what happened on January 6th was horrible, I think she's essentially reacted by becoming indistinguishable from a Democrat on the topic. But at the same time, I kind of admire is the wrong word, but I respect somebody who stands by what they have decided to do, even though they know it's going to tank their political future. She had a shoe-in spot there essentially for life if she wanted it, probably would have won a Senate seat if she wanted it in the future. Of course, has the name to remain in Republican politics if she just kind of toes the line forever. And she chose not to do that because I think sincerely believed that that was the right thing to do. And so while I disagree with her, I do have to kind of respect that she made that decision, even though it was clear it was going to be costly to her.
So Jim, yeah, I'm in this weird place where I've always said, as most people do, we need politicians who are willing to put their careers on the line for something they believe in. And obviously, Liz Cheney has done that. It's just, I would have recommended a different course after she won her first leadership challenge, playing a little bit more of kind of the, Mitch McConnell dancing through the raindrops kind of game on Trump. But she had zero interest in that. She was fired by a great sense of righteousness, I think, mostly understandably. There are some tactical things and some things she did on the committee that I didn't like and didn't think were totally above board, and spoke to a certain fanaticism, and fanatics inherently inevitably make mistakes. But she's going to be remembered well in this episode, even though it's been extremely painful for her. And I think, there are a number of different ways you can go with Trump. If you want Trump to go away, you can sort of do the all out thing that Liz Cheney has done, that Republicans in the House who voted for impeachment did. I mean, if they didn't realize that they're putting their careers on the line, they should have. And almost all of them have been taken down or will be taken down. Then you can do the McConnell thing, which is, it's given McConnell's temperament, given his role in the world, it's kind of a natural fit for him, where you're very shrewd, you're cagey about it, you make it clear what you really think, but you don't emphasize it once you've said it a couple times, you don't go back to it when you're questioned. And then you do another version would be the Ron DeSantis thing, which is you're playing to supplant Trump. So you don't criticize him at all, you play along. with some of the ridiculousness, and you try to convince Republican voters that going forward, you might be the better guy rather than Trump. I think there's a role for all three approaches, and they all of them have something to be said for them. I think at the end of the day, if Trump goes away, it's going to be the supplant approach rather than the frontal approach. But what do you think?
So way back in May 2021, on this very podcast, we talked about Liz Cheney, and I said that I was getting a little irked with her. I saw where she was coming from. Her position was entirely morally justifiable. But by May 2021, the Biden administration was rolling into full effect of trying to enact an extraordinarily progressive agenda that would be harmful to the country, and that I didn't like seeing Republican leaders continuing to pick at the scab of the 2020 election and fighting about Trump and turning every conversation into, what do you think about Trump? When we wanted the country focused to be asking the question, what do you think about what Biden is doing? So I wrapped her on the knuckles, you could say. This is not denouncing her. This was not a full-throated, furious. It was just absolutely like, no, this is not helpful. This is going to generate. One of the things I observe is that anything she says about Trump, even behind closed doors to a Republican group, she's got to know it's going to get leaked. It's going to pick off that scab and set up another news cycle of GOP paralyzed by infighting, when the GOP House caucus needed to be focused on the Biden agenda and arguing against it. I went back and I checked. Some nut job over at the Bulwark said that I was advocating for her being canceled on the National Review podcast. But it's called The Editors. Is it too hard to ask you remember the name? Anyway. Mm-hmm. And I may have blown a gasket over that characterization of my remarks. And I think it's pretty clear when it comes to picking at the scab of the 2020 election, Liz Cheney isn't really the problem here. In the end, looking, you know, maybe in May, it may have looked like that, but clearly Trump's all-consuming obsession with 2020, is, you know, he keeps bringing it front and center, and he keeps talking about it. You look at his Truth Social feed, it's almost the only, you know, he works that into every conversation. So in retrospect, a very mild mea culpa, Liz Cheney in that was, and she's what she's doing here is she's saying, look, there are some things to me that are more important than getting reelected. I'm standing up for what I think is right, and I don't care if my, you know, if the voters back home think I'm wrong. I have to do this. This is not a matter of right or left. This is a matter of right or wrong. Lots of Americans say they want leaders who are willing to take this stand right up until the moment they get it. And then it's like, no, I don't want you to do it that way. And I want you to do it only when I agree with you. That's when you should take a stand and all that kind of stuff. Well, clearly she's toast tonight. And it's, you know, unfortunate, but very predictable. And I foresaw it. And I think she accepted those consequences. My other lingering frustration with it is that there have been reports that Liz Cheney is apparently seriously thinking about running for president, or the idea that somebody in the 2024 Republican field has to be running on an explicitly anti-Trump message. The Republican Party as a whole may be open to being a post-Trump party. I think that's the most useful moniker for the Ron DeSantis brand of combining some of Trump populism with traditional conservatism and going with that approach. There is no room for an anti-Trump. It's not going to go anywhere. You're going to be, if you're lucky, John Kasich in 2016, who effectively was running to be president of Ohio. You're going to be, you know, or you're going to be Mark Sanford, and
he won. He was elected president of Ohio. Remember that?
Yes. That group, you know. Oh my God.
Betty Cannon
won the primary, and he acted like it's the meme of the guy who's splashing the champagne, kissing the girl, biting the metal, and you find out he's in eighth place. You know, the only way Donald Trump is not the Republican nominee in 2024 is if it's down to him and one other option, and Republicans really like that one other option. Ron DeSantis has a shot to be that guy. It's not a guarantee, but he's got a shot at it. Right now, I don't see anybody, and Liz Cheney is not going to be that guy, nor is Larry Hogan, nor is any Republican who's, you know, posed as the explicitly anti-Trump. The party can only move past Trump. It will not renounce Trump. Mm-hmm. And people who keep waiting for that day to come are going to be waiting for Godot.
Yeah, I totally agree. Al Opponent had a good post on what to make of what she could do after this. And, you know, his takeaway was she's only going to help Trump, because if she runs in the primary, she's going to siphon votes from some other more plausible anti-Trump candidate, assuming there is one. And if she runs as an independent in a general, she's going to siphon some anti-Trump votes that might have gone to the Democrat to herself and help Trump that way. So I don't think any of that would make sense. But I'm also going to, you pricked my conscience, Jim, and I'm going to mea culpa as well, because I was very irritated. You know, I was just saying this earlier with the way she handled things after she won her first leadership race. But it was clear that for her, where she was, there was no opening to be, you know, a kind of a reasonable non-Trump vote in the House Republican caucus, given the way things were going, given how obsessed Trump is with 2020, given how Trump was making this a litmus test for everything, given now how we know he's elevated all these Stop the Steal candidates all over the map. I think Axios had a rundown of the Stop the Steal candidates. Trump succeeded in getting over the top in the primaries. And I think their count in Arizona was that it was 13 for 13, you know, so it was just going to be impossible for Cheney. On the other hand, Charlie, we've talked about this a lot, like one of the key tests and real challenges in the Trump era is how do you stay true to where you were? I mean, assuming you want to stay where you were, you want to be a conservative and, you know, appropriately critical of Trump, not driven crazy by Trump, kind of not moved off of your true north. And with Cheney, I mean, she has a big claim. Look, I would have been appalled by a riot on the U.S. Capitol, you know, in 2005, and I'm equally appalled now. And I think she's right about that. But when she says that she wouldn't vote for Ron DeSantis or has to think about it, that to me is an indication. Whoops, she has been moved from where she would have been in the past.
Well, it is and it isn't. It's a sign of monomania and one's view of what happened on January 6th and one's view of Trump and one's view of Ron DeSantis will determine whether or not one thinks that monomania is justified. But if you believe that what happened on January 6th was not the temporary madness or unique, sui generis, impetuousness of one man, Donald Trump, but the product of a party, a symptom of an underlying disease, then you will start running through other Republicans and tarring them with the same brush.
Mm-hmm.
You will start saying, well, look, if Ron DeSantis can't forthrightly condemn what happened, if he's not prepared to talk about it all the time, then he is indulging it, qui tacit consentire, and therefore I can't. I am about to say something that's going to annoy some people, but I think is true. Political parties are not debating societies, and they're not the Vatican. When political parties make mistakes, or when political parties elevate people who are bad news, the way they get out of the predicament into which they have plunged themselves is not with a cleansing process or with a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I know people want there to be one. I have this instinct in myself. I would love to see Trump repudiated. I would love to see a poll that said that only 5% of Republican primary voters think that he should be the nominee in 2024. That only 5% of Republican primary voters think that he's fit for office. I'd love to see that. But it's not going to happen. And it didn't happen last time. Ronald Reagan did not spend the years between Richard Nixon's resignation in 1974 and his own victory in 1980 constantly lambasting Richard Nixon, Richard Nixon's friends, Richard Nixon's fans in the Republican primary electorate. He didn't do it. Maybe he should have. Maybe we think that in a cosmic sense, this makes him immoral. But he didn't do it because he understood that his role was to supplant Nixon. Easier, of course, then, because Nixon had resigned, than it is for a Ron DeSantis to do it with Trump. That his role was to supplant and build upon the last guy. The Republican Party needs people like Liz Cheney who will stand up and say what is true. Again, I wish more people did it. I wish that the Republican base were in a place to hear it. I have no problem doing it. I'm a writer. But the people who actually get rid of Trump, the people who rid us of this turbulent priest, are not going to do so by talking like Liz Cheney.
Mm-hmm.
And again, let's stipulate that that says something bad about the Republican base, about the partisan nature of our politics, about our current culture. But it is true. It is true whether or not it should be true. It's true whether or not I like it. And this brings me to Liz Cheney. I think Liz Cheney is right about Donald Trump. I think she's broadly right about January 6th. I also think that for whatever reason, she has decided to proceed in a way that is not going to convince the people who need convincing. She talks in a manner that takes her out of the running as a leader within the Republican Party, as most likely a congresswoman from Wyoming, certainly as a presidential contender in 2024. And as somebody who's not involved on the practical side of politics, I'm fine with that, because I think we need the Liz Cheneys who will stand up and tell the truth. And I think we need the Ron DeSantises who will look to supplant Trump next time around, at least I hope. And I think we need the Mitch McConnells who will dance through the raindrops, as you put it. And then I think we need people who just don't want to talk about it at all because they understand that there are trade-offs in politics that purity doesn't allow for. So I think that one of the mistakes that the commentariat has made in the last few years is to give itself this entirely unrealistic hope or prediction as to how this is going to end. It is almost certainly not going to end with Donald Trump in an orange jumpsuit. It did not end, for political reasons, although I think it should have, in Donald Trump's impeachment. And it is not going to end with Liz Cheney being president of the United States. It's mm-hmm. going to end in a muddled, right. muddy, grubby way that will please no one, but that hopefully, come 2024, will leave us relieved of Donald Trump's presence at the center of American life.
Life isn't a West Wing episode, but
it's not.
Very optimistic to think it's going to end. So I think it's not. We can't have certainty on that. So Jim, let me go to you for the exit question first. Maybe an impossible to answer exit question. So welcome back. Welcome back to France, Jim. Getting this impossible to answer exit question first. So whose approach to Donald Trump is more admirable in your view, Liz Cheney or Glenn Youngkin?
Oh, between the two, that's an impossible question. That's the easy one. Glenn Youngkin, which is you embrace him when you think he's doing something good. You criticize him.
So you think that's more admirable? I would say certainly more efficacious.
If you know, we just saw a whole bunch of GOP lawmakers who voted to impeach Trump lose their primaries. And if you think you can do a lot for this country from a studio on CNN or a studio on MSNBC as former Congressman so-and-so, I guess. I mean, we have a whole bunch of people who do that. We've had Joe Walsh doing that for a long time. We have no shortage of former Republican officials, Michael Steele, who will go on cable news and say, what Donald Trump is doing is terrible. We don't have many people in office who are willing to say, well, Trump wants to do this, but we can get the same results if we do this. And oh, by the way, that's constitutional. So, I guess the question is, Stephen Covey, begin with the end in mind. What is your goal here? What mm-hmm. is your actual objective? If you want to actually enact conservative policies, then you have to be in office, which requires you to win a primary, which means you have to, at minimum, not antagonize all the people who you want to elect you into office.
Suzanne, we have a Glenn Youngkin on the board and not even a close call. Not even close call, Glenn Youngkin.
Yeah, I think I agree, but the reason I think so kind of boils down to what Charlie was saying about the purpose of what you're doing as a politician or what our politics are about, right? Liz Cheney and people who talk about Trump the way that she does, really belong in the commentary world, and they talk like they're, it's some kind of religious purge, or it's really about having this pure ideology within the party. And that's not really what politics is about. We have the luxury of talking about it like that, I think. And I think it's important to have people who do so, but that's not really what I would like my politicians to be doing. I think it's important for politicians to not compromise on principle, not lie, not say things they don't believe or agree with, or things that they think are wrong. Certainly not to tell falsehoods, but to stay in office so that they can accomplish actual conservative things that are good for our country, good for their constituents. And you really can't do that if you think your role is to, you know, always be lambasting or purifying, you know, lambasting Trump or purifying the party of people who support him.
Charlie?
Well, I think we need both. I think we need both, not only because that's the way that you navigate these waters in politics, but because Glenn Youngkin and Liz Cheney play different roles in our constitutional order. And it makes sense for Liz Cheney to be focused on this. She is a member of Congress. Congress mm-hmm. performs oversight on the executive branch, and it was Congress whose functions were interrupted. Of course she should be on this committee, and of course she should speak out. Glenn Youngkin is the governor of Virginia. It's fine with me if Glenn Youngkin wants to say, affirm that the election wasn't stolen, or that Donald Trump shouldn't have said this or that, but he is the governor of Virginia. And one of the problems we have, in my view, in this country is that everybody who is below the federal level wants to talk about national issues, wants to pretend that they're a federal politician. Well, Glenn Youngkin is not. I'm glad that he seems primarily focused on Virginia. That's his job.
So, Charlie, gun to your head, whose approach is more admirable?
Well, I'm honestly not trying to be irritating in rejecting the premise, but they have different jobs. So approach to what?
See, this is why I tried to tell Jim it was an impossible, difficult question to answer. But he didn't believe me.
I mean, if I can rewrite your question for you, Rich, we could ask whose approach is more admirable, Liz Cheney's or Mitch McConnell's? They're both federal politicians.
Yeah.
I think Liz Cheney's approach is more admirable, but Mitch McConnell's approach is more pragmatic and is more likely to yield the results that McConnell wants than the results that Liz Cheney wants.
I accept both your rewriting of the question and your answer. I think what Liz Cheney has done, even though I've been irritated by it, is not the approach I'd want everyone to take. Obviously, I think it is more admirable, but I think the McConnell or Youngkin approach is shrewder and more efficacious. And if you had everyone going down the Liz Cheney route, what you would have is a completely Trumpified party, completely Trumpified, because they'd all lose primaries, they'd all go down, and Trump would be completely triumphant, not just, you know, two-thirds triumphant or whatever proportion you want to put on it at the moment. So with that, Charlie, we're going to really put the pressure on you. We want you to up the ante. We want you to top your Bowl and Branch read with a Moink read, if you can.
Well, I don't know about topping it, but as our listeners know, I do truly, earnestly love Moink, and more than Sarah Schutte. I think if we were to rank my love for Moink and Sarah Schutte's love for Moink, hers would be high, but mine would be just that little bit above. And in some ways, I credit myself for Sarah's love of Moink. I think she's a Moink protege of mine. And well, she might be.
Are you going to accept that, Sarah? Are you going to accept being downgraded to a Moink protege? You've done your own Moink reads.
I have indeed. I have no comment.
Wow, which
I can tell in the tone of Sarah's voice that she's not pleased with this.
Which came first, the grass-fed chicken or the egg? I think it was the grass-fed chicken, along with the grass-fed and grass-finished beef and lamb, pastured pork, sustainable wild-caught Alaskan salmon, which comes courtesy of Moink straight to my door and can come straight to your door as well. Moink farmers farm like our grandparents did. And as a result, Moink meat tastes like it should, because the family farm does it better. The Moink difference is a difference you can taste, and you can feel good knowing you're helping family farms stay financially independent too. So how this works? sort of Netflix, but for meat. Except you get to choose what the programming looks like. You choose the meat that's delivered in every box. Ribeyes, chicken breasts, pork chops, salmon fillets, and much more. And if you want to, you can cancel anytime. But you won't want to. In fact, over the weekend, my wife wasn't feeling too well. And so she asked me if I would go out and get everyone food so she didn't have to cook. And I said, sure. And my four-year-old had a tantrum and said, no, 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 no. And he would not rest until he had been given some meatballs made with moink meat, which was a little annoying at the time, but is a testament, I think, to how good moink is. Which is why Shark Tank host Kevin O'Leary called Moink's bacon the best bacon he's ever tasted. And Ring doorbell founder Jamie Siminoff jumped at the chance to invest in Moink because their meat really is that good. And if you want to take advantage of the great offer we have for you, you can keep American farming going by signing up at moinkbox.com/editors right now. And listeners of this show will get free filet mignon in every order for a year. That's 1 year of the best filet mignon you'll the best filet mignon you'll ever taste. But this is for a limited time only. It's spelled moinkbox.com, in case you're wondering. That's moinkbox.com/editors if you want the promo, and you will not be disappointed.
Wow, Charlie, that was fantastic. I'm just glad right now you don't use Babbel, or I'd be almost completely put out of business as someone who's reading our sponsors. So great job. We all love Moink. We can't endorse it heartily enough, and we urge everyone to check it out. So Jim Garrity, let's go to just heartrending news out of upstate New York at this literary and arts festival. Salman Rushdie is waiting, I believe, if I have this correct, to go on stage. Of course, there's been a fatwa against him going 40 years now from his novel Satanic Verses. And this guy just subjects him to a frenzied stabbing attack. Rushdie, thank God, survives. He's on a ventilator briefly. The reports, at least as of a couple of days ago, is likely to lose an eye. His liver was wounded. Just horrifying. And Jessica, we were talking about this before we started to record. Just if you just imagine the cloud that Salman Rushdie has lived under literally for decades, and maybe has thicker skin than the rest of us, but there must have been some pit of fear in his stomach nearly constantly, you know, again, for decades. And perhaps it was beginning to fade. I think his security, you know, he wasn't in hiding anymore, or at least was more public than he had been. Maybe the security had loosened. Maybe the thought was this thing is finally fading towards being no longer a factor. And then boom, this happens.
So a couple of weeks ago, there was this general, I don't want to say sense of optimism, but a sense of American satisfaction that Ayman al-Zawahiri, the current head of al-Qaeda, or at the time, met the wrong end of a flying Ginsu Hellfire missile and was last seen spread all over a chunk of Kabul. And there was that sense of, we in America, we don't forget, right? It's been a long time since 9/11. It's been more than 20 years, but by golly, we are here. You know, we're never going to forget. We'll hunt you down. We'll get you. There's no place you can hide. Sooner or later, we're going to find you. And now the Islamists have their own sense of that. Iran in particular, the Ayatollah can say, oh, sure, you escaped our attempts to assassinate you in the past. You have spoken in many occasions. You've made many television appearances. You've managed to live evading our attempts to kill you for many, many years. But we got, we came close this time. We managed to wound you pretty seriously, according to the most recent accounts. So it feels like a giant setback. It feels like a giant sense of this. There are two kind of consequences that come out of this. The first is that there's nothing we can do at this point. We're not in charge of the security arrangements around Salman Rushdie. Apparently there were two cops there, but some of the accounts suggested it was the crowd that stopped the guy. It was not the cops. And I know that Rushdie's had to live with these elaborate security measures his entire life and hoping that, you know, today isn't the day that somebody slips through and manages to get close to him with a knife or a gun or a bomb or something else. There are two things we can do. The first is to, when we denounce this, to not include any element of yes, but. Now, you didn't see a lot of this, but, you know, social media spotlights every lunatic and nut job and extremist out there. And there were a few people who were like, oh, it's terrible, but he really shouldn't have written that. The idea that somehow he invited this upon himself. The Al Jazeera's account and others had done some really appalling messaging regarding this. And the second thing is that because this is all the result of a fatwa from the Ayatollah, previously Khomeini, now it's Khamenei, why would the U.S. be pursuing a nuclear deal with this regime? Why would we be pursuing any form of cooperation with that government? They're already trying to kill U.S. officials. They're already trying to kill some critic of the regime living in Brooklyn. Why are we sitting down at the negotiating table with them? But I don't expect any good answers for this from the Biden administration.
So, Zan, per that yes, but that Jim was referring to, this is something that Salman Rushdie himself has been outspoken about for a long time now, saying that when this fatwa was first issued, basically all of the literary world and the intellectual and journalistic world rallied around him, but then he could feel it steadily, that kind of sentiment lessening. And he spoke out first, I believe, around the time of the awful Charlie Hebdo. Hebdo, is that how you say it?
Charlie Hebdo.
Hebdo attack. And you know, there are people who said, yeah, you know, maybe they just shouldn't have said it. we don't believe people should be killed for satirical magazine, but you know, just as Jim says, and now obviously there's been a real illiberal turn on these kind of issues where people think that speech that's distasteful to people is a form of violence, that the worst thing you can do is say or write something that's offensive to some privileged or protected group. So the sentiment that used to be near universal around a defense of free speech in this regard has significantly given way.
Yeah, this is something I find very frightening. And I don't know if it's because of how I was raised or the kind of communities I grew up in or the things I was, you know, told we believe as Americans. But one of the most frightening and abhorrent beliefs a person could have from my perspective is the idea that some things shouldn't be said. And I, you know, people say things to me and around me and that I read that I disagree with on, you know, the most fundamental level possible. And yet my first impulse or none of my impulses would ever be that person shouldn't be allowed to say that. And I find this so odd in the context of, you know, commenting on writing about abortion, because people say to me all the time and I read all the time these morally abhorrent, atrocious arguments about why it's okay to kill unborn human beings in the womb. And yet it would never occur to me to suggest that people shouldn't be allowed to argue that, because that's how we get to the truth, right? Them sharing their view and me being allowed to share mine is how we convince people who are paying attention to agree with us, is how I convince the person who has that morally abhorrent belief that they're wrong. And I can't convince them that they're wrong if I'm too busy shouting them down and telling them they're not allowed to say what they think. And so whether this looks like, you know, in the campus context, or it looks like your speech is violence, or it looks like removing op-eds from New York Times or apologizing for them because they're hurtful, or it looks like stabbing a guy for what he says openly and courageously, even though he knows someone or many people might be trying to kill him. I think this is evil, and I think it's anti-human, because being able to say what we believe or even just float arguments that we're not sure about or want to talk through or have heard is fundamental to being human. And we can't cooperate as a society if we're too busy silencing one another for saying things that we don't agree with.
Yeah, so conscience is fundamental to being human, and reason is fundamental to being human. And there are conscience rights and free speech rights elements to both of those, obviously. Charlie?
I want to very slightly disagree with Alexandra not in the thrust of what she was saying, which I agree entirely, but in the invocation of a pragmatic or practical or efficacious argument to sustain the right to free speech. It is, of course, true that without free speech, we can't convince other people. It is, of course, true that one of the benefits of free speech is that it helps us arrive at the truth. But I don't consider that to be a prerequisite. Let's suppose that Islam were literally true in every particular. Should Salman Rushdie have any more or less rights than he has now? Let's suppose that Alexandra had convinced everyone in the world that abortion was wrong. Would that affect her right to speak? I don't think it would. I understand why people reiterate the product of speech, but I think that this is an intrinsic right. And I think that it is far more simple than our present discourse allows.
Wasn't that what Zan was saying?
Yes, but
I guess I should ask Zan.
I don't think we're disagreeing. I'm trying to build on this by pointing out that the way you end up, and I'm not suggesting this is what Alexandra was saying at all, but the way you end up at the notion that there are some things that shouldn't be said or that there is some speech that is not valuable is you ground the right to free speech in the search for truth or in the need for debate. And what I'm saying is that I don't feel the need to make that case to anybody. I don't feel the need to justify my speech to someone else by proposing that it is useful. If you read books arguing that there is such a thing as hate speech, or that there is speech that is beyond the pale, or that is objective way grotesque, you will see this distinction drawn between speech that is useful in an academic or political or social context and speech that is not. I mean, we don't, I hope, believe that the reason that we protect the speech rights of, say, neo-Nazis is because otherwise they can't convince people of neo-Nazism. We don't think that in America. We think, well, if we're going to have a system in which everyone can speak, they have to be able to as well. That's the practical argument. Or actually, it's an unalienable right, which is less practical. So when I look at Salman Rushdie, I really do just draw everyone into two camps. You know, we like in politics to put ourselves into different groups and call ourselves this or that. You a conservative or a libertarian or a classical liberal or a conservatarian. I did it myself. I wrote a book about it. But on speech, I just think there's pro and there's anti. I think it is Manichaean. I think you either look at Salman Rushdie and you say, there is a guy who wrote a book. He wrote whatever words he wanted to in his book. Someone published them. Others read them. Some liked them. Some didn't. Good for him. Or you look at him and you think he's a problem. And while it is much, much worse to put fatwas on people and stab them in the face, there's not a difference in kind, only in degree, between the people who would look at Salman Rushdie and say he must be killed and the people who would look at Salman Rushdie and say the government should prosecute him or he should have chosen to stay quiet. And I hope that the people who fall into the latter camp, and there are a lot of them, and increasingly there are a lot of them in America, unfortunately, I hope they feel terrible. I hope they look at what happened to him and they feel in some way culpable. I hope they recognize that while they personally would not stab him in the face, or even in some cases ask the government to arrest him on their behalf, I hope they recognize that they have aided the argument that is made against people like Salman Rushdie by proposing over and over again in books and on Twitter and on college campuses and on television shows that there is some good speech and that there is some bad speech and some things are beyond the pale and we need to take into account power dynamics and we need to have a think about whether this is efficacious and we need to worry about whether or not this is speech that can convince or speech that marginalizes, that diminishes, that disparate nonsense. All of it is nonsense. You either believe in it or you don't.
Jim Garrity, exit question to you. Another story over the last week hasn't gotten a lot of attention. What else is with other stuff going on? But also just it's sort of astonishing me to me, even given that it hasn't gotten more attention. A real threat against the life of former National Security Advisor John Bolton, also emanating from Iran, just the same way the fatwa and perhaps the attack itself against Salman Rushdie. In your view, these incidents should be enough for the administration to break off nuclear talks with Iran.
Yes.
Or is the administration?
Yes. Okay.
Yes. Zan, yes. I'll finish the question for you. Or is the administration correct in its implicit view, or maybe they've said this explicitly, that just geopolitical considerations are too high and too consequential to let these incidents end these talks?
I would say this is enough to break them off, but I am saying that mainly because I think that they should have broken them off a long time ago for a variety of other reasons too. And so there might be circumstances in which something similar might happen, but where it might make sense to continue trying diplomacy for various reasons. But given all the factors in this case, I would say it's time to stop.
Charlie Cook.
I think that the reason that the administration should reject the Iran deal is because the Iran deal is a bad deal. I don't think that to acknowledge that one is negotiating with a terrible, terrible regime is per se to walk away. Yes, it was a more extreme circumstances, but you know, Churchill's famous aphorism was that the devil invaded Germany, he would at least make a favorable reference to him in the House of Commons. And eventually Churchill did that, in that he came to an agreement with the Russians, and in particular with Stalin, and ended up covering up some Russian atrocities as a result. So I don't think that it is because of what's happened to Salman Rushdie or the threat on John Bolton that we should. And in fact, if that were the case, I it would be reasonable to say, wait, that was your line? I mean, look at what Iran says every single day about Israel or Jewish people. I think the problem with the Iran deal is the Iran deal.
Yeah, I mean, you make a good case, and it may be that I am letting my just opposition to the Iran deal color my view on this question in particular, but it just seems to me there is a line carrying out or attempting to carry out attacks on people on U.S. soil would be enough, even if you're in favor of the Iran deal or trying to do enough to walk away for some period of time, at least, I would think.
By the way, I misquoted Churchill. He didn't say if the devil invented Germany. He said if the devil invaded hell, which probably gives you some sense of my prejudices as a Brit.
So let me do one plug this episode, interrupt the run Charlie's had of trying to convince folks to buy or sign up for various products. Let me do the same for NR Plus, digital subscription service at nationalreview.com. You know, it's your right to try to frustrate our metered paywall, to dance around different devices, different computers, different browsers. But let me just suggest you really shouldn't be doing it. You really shouldn't be doing it. It kind of cheats us out of what we need people to do increasingly for work, which is just pay for it, which isn't too much to ask. It isn't a high price. We have great first-time deals running at any given moment, and we really do try our best to make this a good experience for our members and try to offer them benefits above and beyond just reading our content, which I think would be enough. I hope it's enough, but you can be invited to exclusive calls with various conservative figures. I am doing one of these in just a couple hours with the great Larry Kudlow, former Reagan official, former Trump official, now, of course, with his own show on Fox Business, longtime friend of NR, and just great, wonderful guy. Obviously has views you want to hear about politics and especially economics, but just a great human being with a wonderful spirit about him. So if you're an NR Plus member, you can be part of that call. You can ask questions. I moderate, but try to get as many questions as possible. So that's just one of the side benefits. You can also be part of our private Facebook group. We have a real robust Facebook group. You can comment on articles and blog posts if you want. Doesn't float everyone's boat, but if you're into that, if you're an NR Plus member, you can do it. And also, just 90% fewer ads. I guarantee you, all the ads you find most obnoxious will just disappear like magic if you sign up for NR Plus and log on to the homepage. So please, please, please sign up for NR Plus. Join tens of thousands of your fellow NR readers who've given up trying to frustrate the metered paywall and signed up. They've signed up for some other reasons as well, but I urge you to do it if you're not already a member. With that, let's hit a few other things before we go. And Jim, I think we've had pretty compelling conversation on this podcast so far, but I know there are many listeners who haven't really cared about that conversation. They just have been waiting to hear more about your French vacation mentioned at the top of this ep.
I was gonna say, there's nothing people love more than looking at other people's vacation photos. Wait, I've got more. So if you happen to be one of my Facebook friends, I'm sorry, because you probably feel like you've been deluged, and probably by about Wednesday or Thursday, like, okay, that's enough. That's great. Love you. You're having the best vacation ever. You all look terrific. Great. In an 8-day span, the Garrities, emulating the Griswolds, hit Paris, Giverny, Etretat, Rouen, Pont du Hoc near Omaha Beach, Juneau Beach, Bayeux, where the tapestry is, Mont Saint-Michel, and Chut, although it's pronounced Chut, even though they mean, I look at it and I say Chartres. Terrific trip, wonderful time. France lives up to the hype and does not, there are no snooty waiters or anything. Arguably one of the highlights is since the moment we said we're going to France, my younger son was like, oh, I want to go to the top of the Eiffel Tower. And my wife was like, that's the most cliched tourist thing ever. I don't want to do that. And he keeps like, can we go? And of course, you have to buy tickets long in advance. But I did go online and I find out you can buy tickets to the second floor. There's like three levels in which you can go up. And as long as you're willing to take the stairs, tickets were available. So 674 steps and some intensely sore thighs later, we made it. Wonderful views, unforgettable experience. And so, yes, sometimes it's okay to do those American tourist cliches.
Fantastic. But what I've been waiting to hear more about this entire episode is not your cliched French vacation, Jim, the Eiffel Tower. Anyone can go on the Eiffel Tower. What's really exciting is to stay home and make homemade pickles, right?
Yes, it's true. And I have been waiting for a few days now to share this with everybody, both my co-hosts here and all of you listeners. If you're a fan of dill pickles, I'm about to change your life. So this recipe is called Easiest Fridge Dill Pickles. It's by this website called Smitten Kitchen. This is a woman who writes many cookbooks and posts videos on Instagram of her cooking adventures. And I saw her post about making homemade pickles. I love pickles, but I always am very daunted by the idea of canning or, boiling a brine or all these various things you have to do. I'm sure that Sarah Schutte has tried it and succeeded, but I'm not going to try. But this recipe is so simple. All you need is preferably good cucumbers, from the farmer's market or something, but any old cucumber will do in a pinch. You need white vinegar, you need dill, and you need salt. That's it. You put it in a jar, you put it in the fridge, and about 3 hours later, the next day, the day after that, you have the best pickles you've ever tasted.
Within 3 hours?
Yeah, within 3 hours, they're already edible as pickles. By the next day, they're better, but they don't last very long in this house. So far, we've eaten two full jars, and I have a liter jar awaiting me when we're done.
Awesome. Well, I love pickles. So hats off to you, Charlie. Two words, espresso martinis.
I love espresso martinis. I have only recently discovered espresso martinis, but they are now a fixture of my dinner. I'm not really a big dessert guy. I will eat dessert, but I'm not really a big dessert guy. But this gives me a great out, because usually people would get dessert and I'd say, you know what, I'll have another glass of wine. And they'd sort of look at me funny, maybe look at me suspiciously. But now I can get the same effect, but have what looks like a dessert, an espresso martini. So if you haven't had an espresso martini, make sure you save it for dessert. And
this is a martini with a shot of espresso in it?
Yeah, but it's all chocolatey and dessert-like. Mm-hmm. It will also, I mean, you have two, they'll blow your head off, so do be careful. But I'm not responsible if you lose your job.
So does it keep you awake at night?
No, that's the...
The decaf espresso martini, or is that not allowed?
That's a great question. I don't know. It should be a sort of push-pull thing, shouldn't it? It should be a mess, but I wasn't after my two.
So I occasionally like a decaf espresso. I can't have a caffeinated one after dinner, but it's just so risky, you know, ordering at a restaurant. You just never quite know. So I did an Intelligence Squared debate yesterday. Intelligence Squared, this outfit that hosts Oxford style debates where the audience votes where they are on the question beforehand and then votes afterwards, and whoever moved the audience wins. The question was, should Trump be prosecuted? I was arguing no. David Blight, a Yale professor, was arguing yes. And when the initial vote came in, I was like, this is a piece of cake, because it was sort of what I expected. I think it was 81-5 in favor of the resolution, which is where you want to be in one of these debates, because you got lots of territory to move people. Whereas, you know, it's hard to get an 81% proposition up to, you know, 83%. So that factor, giving my and also my incredibly compelling arguments, meant that I won the debate. But at the end, it was, I think, 70-15 in favor of prosecuting Trump. And if I had another hour to go, maybe I would have gotten it down to 68. Who knows? But it was a heck of a lot of fun. I love the competition and the rhetorical combat involved in those kind of debates. And they're more important than ever. My hat's off to Intelligence Squared for doing them. And I was I'm privileged to be part of it. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. Jim Garrity, what's your pick?
Rich, circle today on your calendar. Circle it in red. Break out the party hats. Today, August 16th, 2022, I think your piece, Merrick Garland is on the path to the abyss, is the best item in National Review in the last few days. And no, it's not just because I just came back from vacation. I think there's a... It summarizes the ominous tone of these moves, the questions of whether Merrick Garland really is looking down the road at the likely consequences of this. I think the paragraph that jumped out at me is when he says, but the possibility of pressing, you know, charging Donald Trump with crimes, putting him on trial, quote, needless to say, the country is not prepared to adjudicate such questions in a calm, high-minded manner. It will be the O.J. Simpson trial meets the Hiss Chambers case, with a presidential race not in the background, but very much in the foreground, end quote. Ideally, I'd like to like burst into Merrick Garland's office and wave this column in his face and say, have you read this? Have you thought this thing through? Are you ready for the whirlwind that will be reaped? There's going to be a whirlwind. You move ahead with this. I hope you know what you're doing. I hope you're ready for these consequences. And I suspect that he isn't, but very well done, Rich.
Thanks so much, Jim. Zan, what's your pick?
My pick is a piece from, I think it was over the weekend, by Adam Carrington, who's I think he writes for us occasionally. He's an associate professor at Hillsdale. And the title is Don't Conflate Abortion and Losing a Baby to Miscarriage. And it's a response to a silly New York Times op-ed that I also wrote about last week, asking why we talk about miscarriage and abortion differently as a mode of justifying abortion, or that was the argument of the piece. And Adam does a good job responding to this as a father who has lost several babies to miscarriages, pointing out that both abortion and miscarriage are a loss of life, but one is done intentionally.
Joey Cook, what's your pick?
My pick is by Dominic Pino. It's called Free Markets Are in the National Interest. And Dominic pushes back against the idea that we need free markets, but we have to set them in the context of the nation state. We have to ensure that they serve some amorphous conception of the public good. And Dominic says, no, that they are the public good. Central planning is central planning. You have free markets or you don't. But the idea that free markets are somehow set apart from or in tension with the idea of the nation state is wrong.
So my pick is a corner post by our colleague Andrew Stutterford, The Baltic Monuments War, the Narva Tank, the Soviet era memorial, is rolled out. And just sometimes, not that I was involved in assigning this, not that anyone assigned it to him, I assume, because we usually don't assign a corner post. But if you're just going to assign, Andrew, we got something that involves the Baltics. You know, Andrew knows the Baltics better than anyone and involves kind of symbols and monuments, you know, which Andrew has an interest in and very wise things to say about it. And it involves European history. This is like Andrew Stutterford was born to write this blog post. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Zan. Thank you, Jim. Thanks to Ball and Branch and Moink. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.